Good evening. This evening we continue our study of the period of time there between the Old Testament and the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament, as we have looked in weeks past, looking at the end of the Babylonian Empire leading into the Medes and the Persians, and looking at some of the prophecies that took place there at the end, the writings of Daniel and Nehemiah, Ezra, Ezekiel, Malachi, and others that were living during those last days of the Lord speaking to them, the time before the famine that Amos had prophesied in Amos chapter 8, then verse 12, that there would be a famine that would fall upon the land. And as we looked at these things, we want to keep in mind the things that were going on. Of course, the last time we talked about these things, we looked at Alexander the Great and noted that at his death, the generals were rushing to fight over the scraps of the empire. And we brought our attention to Daniel chapter 8 once again when we look at that vision that Daniel received there during the reign of Belshazzar, as it was coming to the end of the Babylonian Empire. Daniel is an older man by this time. He's not at his furthest extent, but he's reaching the end of his life. He received this vision here, this vision of a ram with two horns that was there in the opening. And as we look through Daniel chapter 8, we can see that it's explained that ram with the two horns represents the Medes and the Persians. And we also noted that as the vision continued, that he saw a he-goat coming up out of the west with one notable horn. And it was coming across the ground. It shows that in such a rapid way that his feet weren't even touching the ground. And he came up to the ram with the two horns, and he pretty much decimated the ram with the two horns, throwing it to the ground and destroying it. And then once that one notable horn had been magnified, it was broken and four horns rose in its place. And that's really where we are. When we look at this vision and the things, it's shown there in Daniel chapter 8 in the latter portion of that chapter when the vision is explained to him that this will be the Grecian Empire that would come up. And we noted Alexander the Great was that one notable horn that came up, and we looked at the speed with which he went across and conquered the Medes and the Persians, going all the way to the Indus River and doing all that he can and wanting to go further and his men refusing. And within just about a year of him turning back, less than a year, he died there in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar there in Babylon. And that's where we find the generals there. As we noted last week, we saw that the generals were beginning to fight over the scraps, as we spoke of. That in the beginning, there was the general Perdiccas that was made the guardian of the two heirs. One of them was Alexander's son, who was born after his death. And the other was his half-brother, Philip, who was somewhat, well, he wasn't all there. He was challenged, we'll put it that way. And so he was watching over those two. And the rest of the empire was divided up with Ptolemy over Egypt, Seleucus ruling Babylon, Antipater ruling Macedonia and Greece, and Antigonus in Asia Minor. Now, as we noted in our lesson 2 weeks ago, it was just a very short period of time after the death of Alexander that his son Alexander was put to death. His wife Roxana was put to death. His mother Olympias was put to death. His half brother Philip was put to death, along with his wife. They were all put to death, and there were no longer any heirs to the throne. No one was left of the household of Alexander. And so Perdiccas was one of the first ones put to death, the general that was supposed to be watching over all of them. And so with no apparent heir to the throne, the generals began to fight. And from around 321 BC to around 301 BC, the fight continues. And it ends up with the three strongest remaining, that of Ptolemy there in Egypt, Seleucus Nicator there in the Syrian Empire, taking over the throne there in Babylon, and Antiochus Gonatas ruling there in Macedonia and Thrace. These three became the major powers that resulted from the Grecian Empire. But if you would take a note, as we noted 2 weeks ago, Antiochus Gonatas and the Macedonian Empire, this section is real far away from the Jews. And really, he plays no part whatsoever in the life of the Jews from that point on, that empire. So we're just gonna kind of leave them behind and go on and move on and look at the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Because if you'll note, Judea is right here between these two. In the beginning, when they had the peace treaty there in Issus in 301 BC, it was agreed that Seleucus Nicator and the Syrian Empire would receive Judea, And Ptolemy apparently agreed to that, but quickly decided he didn't really want to fulfill that agreement. And he went and he took over Judea, the area of Palestine, and all the way up there towards Damascus, and kept that under his control. The Ptolemies continued to rule over Egypt and other areas until the days of Cleopatra. And just understand, when I start talking about Cleopatra, that doesn't mean it's the one you're thinking of, because we're going to go through about as many Cleopatras as we go through Ptolemies in our lesson this evening. And so let's begin looking at these things as we look at Ptolemaic Egypt. Of course, the first ruler there is Ptolemy Soter. He's the general of Alexander the Great. He's the one that takes over the Egyptian Empire. And after he's fought his battles and taken the land that he thinks that he deserves, he decides, well, I'm gonna work on making Alexandria a much greater city. Remember, Alexandria had been mapped out by Alexander when he took over Egypt, and he had mapped out exactly how he wanted things to be, and his idea was to make a Grecian city that the world could look at and see how great the Grecian culture was. And Ptolemy continued that work. He continued to build there in Alexandria. And over time, he continued to build more, and he followed in the footsteps of Alexander, in that he named several cities after himself. He built Ptolemais on the Upper Nile. He also rebuilt the old city Acho, which we can read up in Judges chapter 1, and renamed it Ptolemais. And it's known by the current name Acre today. As he continued building and everything, we noted in our lesson 2 weeks ago that Ptolemy, when he went in and took over Jerusalem, he noted a weakness there amongst the Jews, and that is the fact that they would not do anything on the Sabbath day. They would not rise up and fight. They wouldn't rise up and work. They would just worship their God. And he took advantage of that, attacking them on the Sabbath and slaughtering the people there, and destroying the city of Jerusalem, destroying the walls of the city of Jerusalem. Remember, they had been rebuilt under the governorship of Nehemiah when they had returned from the Medo-Persian Empire. And so here, once again, the city of Jerusalem is being destroyed. The walls are being destroyed, and they remain destroyed for a period of time. But after that initial attack, where he took advantage of that weakness, it seems that the Jews pretty much got forgotten about. They were looked at primarily as a buffer. Remember, you've got the Ptolemies down there in Egypt and the Seleucids up there in Syria. And what better than to have a nice buffer zone? Any of you guys who've played, who've ever played Risk, you know, we have those little places, and it usually ends up there in the Middle East as a buffer zone between various warring factions. And that's exactly what we see here. The Ptolemy Soter is using it primarily as a buffer. Now, with the death of Ptolemy Soter around 282 BC, his son Ptolemy Philadelphus takes over. And as Ptolemy Philadelphus takes over there around 286 and rules till around 247 BC, Ptolemy Philadelphus is famous for a couple of things. Number one, his name. It's interesting when you read these histories, the Ptolemy the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way down through the 15th. Those are late additions. You'll notice all of these have nicknames that the Greeks would give them. Philadelphus, we know from the city Philadelphia, means brotherly love. Really, this would be more of a sisterly love that he had, because he loved and married his sister Arsinoe. And before you get too weirded out, you better get used to it, because it's going to get worse than that as we continue on looking at the Ptolemies. But he married his sister Arsinoe. He's famous for that. And he's also known for two other major events. He continued to work there in Alexandria, wanting to make it a major seaport. And so he built the Lighthouse of Alexandria. Now, the Lighthouse of Alexandria became to be known as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Just imagine, if you would, you're there in the Mediterranean Sea, and this large lighthouse here drawing you in, showing you the way to safe harbor. Now, it's there at this Lighthouse of Alexandria that another major event in the days of Ptolemy Philadelphus takes place. It's the Lighthouse of Alexandria was built there on the island of Pharos. And Ptolemy Philadelphus decided, well, I want to build a library, I want to build a museum, I want to bring together all the great ancient works of the world and bring them together. And he heard about the ancient manuscripts of the Hebrews. And so, as the story goes, there's a couple of different ways it is told. It's believed most likely that he sought after at least 70 individuals, elders, from the tribes of Israel. When you look at the legends that are given, it says that there's six from each tribe, which would be 72. But if you remember, when the northern kingdom of Israel was carried away into Assyrian captivity, it was scattered throughout the empire, and the northern kingdom of Israel never returned. And so how someone could know exactly which tribe they were from, because their records had been destroyed, they had been scattered throughout the empire of Assyria, it's very unlikely that they had six from every tribe. But most likely there were 70. And as the legend continues, it gets a little bit more fanciful. It says that those 72 men were taken, put there in the base of the lighthouse, and they were put in separate rooms, and each of them translated the Old Testament Scriptures, and then at the end of 72 days, they came together. Imagine this, they all were exactly identical. Now, we can know that's not the truth. Those are just some of the legends that were told about 100 or so years later. And it seems that some were trying to give it some kind of a supernatural way of it having come to be, that it wasn't just them coming together. But we should be very thankful to Ptolemy Philadelphus and the work that he did here in the translating of the Septuagint, because it is that translation, the Septuagint, that was used by Jesus, that was used by His apostles. When you look at the quotations of the Old Testament there in the New Testament, the majority of those, about six of every seven of the quotations, come from the Greek Septuagint, not from the Hebrew Scriptures. And so this is something that happened there around 250 B.C. There on the island of Pharos. Now as we continue along, after Ptolemy Philadelphus passes away, Ptolemy the Third, Ptolemy Euergetes, which means simply benefactor, took over in 247 B.C. He's called benefactor because he successfully pushed the borders of the empire. He led the armies of Egypt beyond the Euphrates River and was able to recapture, I guess you could say, the various temple items that had been stolen by Cambyses, the son of Cyrus of the Medes and the Persians, and bring them back and reinstall them in the temples that they had, to bring back all those Egyptian gods. Under his rule, the Ptolemaic Empire reached its largest extent. Now, as we go on from him, we kind of start our downhill slide on the Ptolemies. The next one in line is Ptolemy the Fourth, Ptolemy Philopater. And really, there's not much that's said about him other than this is where the beginning of the decline of the Ptolemies really takes place. His son, Ptolemy the Fifth, became ruler around 203 B.C., Ptolemy V there was 5 years old when his father was killed. And his father was killed by two individuals by the name of Agathocles and Sosibius. And once again, these don't say that my pronunciation is the absolute way that I have to do it. I'm just doing the best I can. But they were two of his father's favorites that had him put to death. And then they had his mother, also his aunt. Once again, this was a man who married his sister, and so his dad and mother, also his uncle and aunt, I guess you would say, were put to death rather quickly. And he's taken by another general, Lepolemus, who puts those two to death and takes him under his wing and begins to help him out in ruling the empire. Now, as we continue looking at Ptolemy Euergetes, Ptolemy Philopater, it's during this period of time that after his death that we have the Antiochus the Fourth. I jumped the gun there. Not Antiochus the Fourth. I apologize. I got a page out of. There we go. Okay. It's during this period of time that Philip V of Macedon and Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great, who was ruling over the Seleucid Empire, began to divide up the empire of the Ptolemies. They began to take over certain areas, such as Judea and other areas. And it's also during the time of Ptolemy V, and when I get through all these Ptolemies, you'll understand why. When you look at this page and you see 15 Ptolemies, it's hard to keep them all together. But it's during this time that the Rosetta Stone was carved. And this is a very interesting stone. You remember we talked about the Behistun inscription during the days of Darius. They were upon that cliff face and that it was inscribed in three different languages. Well, if you could see nice and clearly, it's hard to get a good picture. You've got one language up here, the hieroglyphs, and then you've got two other languages. One of them is in Greek capitals, and the other one is in Demotics. And like the Behistun inscription, this allowed the archaeologists, when it was first discovered in 1799 by Napoleon, and then eventually it fell into British hands. It ended up in the British Museum, where it remains today. Around 1818 to 1822, a Frenchman by the name of François Champollion deciphered the inscription and discovered that it was an inscription about Ptolemy V, talking about how made by Egyptian priests around 200 BC, commending his policies and expressing gratitude for favors and some matters of current events. This is something that was inscribed there during the days of Ptolemy V. Now, as Ptolemy V passes away, Ptolemy VI, Philometor, comes in. Now, Ptolemy V was married to Cleopatra. Was married to Cleopatra I, who was the daughter of Antiochus III. Now, this is not the famous Cleopatra of Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. You're going to have to wait about seven more Cleopatras before we get to that one. But this was the daughter of the ruler of the Syrian Empire, the enemy empire, and they kind of decided to bring some peace and had him marry his daughter. Now, as Ptolemy V passes away, Ptolemy VI, Philometor comes in and rules with his mother Cleopatra until her death around 176 BC. Then he married his daughter, Cleopatra II. Now, just pause for a moment, if you would, and imagine being in the palace, and someone says, "Cleopatra, come here." And there's Cleopatra I, and there's Cleopatra II. We're going to get a little bit later, and there's a Cleopatra Bernice, a Cleopatra the Fourth, Cleopatra V, Cleopatra VI, and all seem to be living along the same period of time until they start killing each other off. Can you just imagine dealing with the names there? During this period of time, he was invaded twice by Antiochus IV, who was over the Seleucid Empire, that Syrian Empire that we talked about. And in fact, Antiochus IV, also known as Epiphanes, which means God, God manifest. I hate it when things just slip out of your mind. But it was also known as God manifest. He became king over the Egyptians for a period of time until the Roman Senate said, "All right, look, you got to go back home." And so pay attention. Here we are in around 180 to 145 BC, and we're already reaching a period of time where the Romans are beginning to enter the scene, where their power is beginning to stretch out. We see that the Egyptians continue on for a period of time, but it's not long before they fall under the Roman Empire. Now, when Ptolemy VI passes away, his son Ptolemy VII, and this is an interesting thing when you look at it, Ptolemy VII, if you look in some places, he's going to also be referred to as Ptolemy VIII. Once again, these numbers were added at a later time, and depending on which account you look at, he may be one or the other. Began ruling around 170 BC and ruled to around 116 BC. He had the nickname of Sycon. I don't think he was a psycho. Sycon means sausage, potbelly, or bladder. In other words, they were referring to he was Ptolemy the Fat. Essentially, was what they referred to him as. He began his rule when Antiochus invaded Egypt. He is the brother of Ptolemy VI. When his brother came back, when he was released as a prisoner, when Antiochus was told to leave, he agreed to a joint rule with Philometor, his brother, and remember Cleopatra II, their sister. So you've got Ptolemy VI, Philometor, Ptolemy VII, Euergetes, and Cleopatra II, their sister. Ptolemy VI and Cleopatra are married, and then Ptolemy VII, their brother, they're all ruling together. Now, any of you who have more than one child understand that that's not going to work. When you've got brothers and sisters ruling together, it's just not going to work. After a period of time, in an effort to promote peace, Philometor offered his brother Euergetes, his younger brother, Ptolemy VII, his daughter, Cleopatra, Thea, as a wife. Now, you do the math, you do the family tree. We're staying in that single line. This is his niece. that he's marrying, that his brother is giving him for a wife. And in all honesty, it really rapidly goes downhill from there. As we look at these things, we see that as we continue on down, it's just Ptolemies and Cleopatras that continue to fight, marry, and rule, and it begins to play out more and more like your favorite soap opera or the worst soap opera you can imagine. You have Ptolemy the Ninth, Letheros, known as Letheros, who ruled from 116 to 81 BC, part of the time ruling with his brother Ptolemy the Tenth of Alexander. Ptolemy the Tenth ruled with his mother Cleopatra until he killed her and married his niece Bernice the Third. Bernice the Third was also known as Cleopatra Bernice, as if it wasn't confusing enough already. And she ruled alone from the time of her death, her husband's death in 81 BC to 80 BC. Possibly she was ruling jointly as early as 100 BC, until Rome forced her to marry Ptolemy the Eleventh, also known as Alexander the Second, who was at best her stepson and half-brother, but most likely was her own son that she married. Then it just continues to get worse. Ptolemy the Twelfth, Ilutes, which means pipe player, and referred to as chubby cheeks. He ruled from 80 to 58 BC when Rome came in and took him out of the picture, and he doesn't come back in the picture until 55 BC. During his absence, his wife, Cleopatra the Fifth, who may or may not have been his half-brother, half-sister, we know that she was an illegitimate daughter of Ptolemy the Ninth, that she ruled along with Bernice the Fourth during Ptolemy the Twelfth's exile to Rome. Bernice possibly had her sister Cleopatra the Fifth poisoned, and then she was forced to marry Seleucus Kibiosoctes, but she didn't like him, and so she had him strangled and continued to rule alone, and was eventually beheaded by her father slash half-brother, who returned from Rome in 55 BC and didn't like her ruling, and so got her out of the picture, and he took back over and ruled until 51 BC. According to various accounts, Cleopatra, the famous Cleopatra, who is the sister of Cleopatra V, and Bernice IV, she watched the beheading. Judging by the way that family is, she probably watched it with joy. And that brings us up to that famous Cleopatra, Cleopatra VII, known as Cleopatra Philopatera, who ruled from 51 BC to 30 BC. She's the famous Cleopatra of Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. She's the one that had Julius Caesar and Mark Antony both as lovers. In fact, she supposedly bore the child of Julius Caesar after he was put to death. Now, during her reign in 51 BC, she began co-rule of Egypt by having her brother, Ptolemy the 13th, marry her. And then, well, just like with any brother and sister combination, there's going to be some infighting take place, and Ptolemy doesn't want to listen to his wife, who is the queen of Egypt, and Ptolemy the 13th is just kind of a figure there. So there begins to be a civil war, and by the best accounts, it appears that Ptolemy the 13th drowned in a crossing of the Nile during this civil war. And so then, as life wasn't bad enough, Cleopatra the 7th married her younger brother, Ptolemy the 14th. But it seems that this marriage and the title that he had as leader of the Egyptian people was purely in name only, because it was during this period of time that Julius Caesar came a-knocking. And in fact, the very same year, you remember the Ides of March in 44 BC, when Julius Caesar was stabbed to death there on the floor of the Senate. It was just a few months later that Ptolemy the 14th was found dead, most likely put to death by his wife, because she wanted to put her son, Ptolemy the 15th, also known as Ptolemy Caesarion, who was supposedly the love child of Julius Caesar, she wanted him to rule on the throne, and she wanted him to be recognized by the Roman Empire as the legitimate heir of the Romans. Like I said, it's a horrible soap opera. And just imagine, all these things are going on. And while we're looking at these things, you need to keep in mind, when we began the lesson this evening, we talked about the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. You had the Seleucids there in the Syrian Empire, and you had the Ptolemies down here in the Egyptian Empire. And we essentially stopped time on the Seleucids, other than mentioning Antiochus III and Antiochus IV. We're going to talk about them, Lord willing, next week. And they're going to be dealing with some of these Ptolemies. You're going to see some of them coming down, and they're really going to be affecting the Jews. Now, we really want to see how all this is having an effect there on the area of Palestine. That's really the point of all this, to see what's happening with the Jews during this period of time. Now, like I said, Ptolemy Soter, he came into Jerusalem, he destroyed the walls of Jerusalem. They're taking advantage of their not doing anything on the Sabbath day but worshiping God. But like I said, after a period of time, it seems that the Ptolemies kind of forgot about them. Antiochus III and Antiochus IV both have an effect there on the area of Judea. But it seems that the Ptolemies were really, after that first one, rather tolerant. And there's a couple of things that we can look at and can see through history that they pretty much left the Jews alone. After the difficulties that they had with Ptolemy I, we read of a fellow by the name of Simon the Just, who was a high priest there in the area of Judea during this period of time of the Ptolemies, who's credited with rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and also building a great reservoir there in that same area. A man by the name of Tobias and his descendants, believed to be tax collectors for Egypt, became bitter rivals with Onias, the high priest Onias I, who was the father of Simon the Just. In fact, Joseph of the house of Tobias got himself appointed tax farmer for Palestine after Onias II had refused to pay Ptolemy Philopater 20 talents of silver. Now, you remember, when we look in the New Testament, how did the Jews feel about tax collectors? They hated them. They thought they were just as bad, if not worse, than the Samaritans. There was this horrible hatred because they viewed them as workers of the enemy. And this appears to be where that hatred really gets started, when you had some of the very Jews that were going and working with the ruling parties and bringing their covetousness into the nation. Josephus tells about this. He says that Onias was one of a little soul and a great lover of money, and that he was so sordidly covetous that nothing of his nature made him ashamed, referring to threats that Ptolemy Euergetes made to him to send soldiers to seize their land. Josephus also records something that happened during the wars of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. In his book, Antiquities, in the 12th chapter, he writes, "Now it happened that in the reign of Antiochus the Great," that was Antiochus the Fourth, "who ruled over all Asia, that the Jews as well as the inhabitants of Celesyria suffered greatly and their land was sorely harassed. For while he was at war with Ptolemy Philopater and with his son who was called Epiphanes, it fell out that these nations were equally sufferers, both when he was beaten and when he beat the others, so that they were very like a ship in a storm, which is tossed by the waves on both sides. And thus were they in their situation in the middle between Antiochus' prosperity and its change to adversity." And he goes on to tell of the victory of Antiochus and the seizure of Judea. And that after Philopater died, his son Epiphanes sent out a great army under Scopas against Celesyria, but he was defeated at the fountains of the Jordan. That's there. If you look on your map, that's up near Tyre there. And so he had passed through this area of Judea all the way up and was defeated there. The Jews are in the midst of all this fighting, this bitter fighting that's taking place between the Seleucid, the Syrian Empire, and the Ptolemy Egyptian Empire. And so as we look at these things, we can see that's the effect that is being had on the Jews. They're in the midst of all this fighting. They're in the midst, and you've got aunts and uncles and sister-in-laws and everything that are ruling over these various places. And that's what they're having to face. And so as you can see, we're moving closer to the period of Christ. We're getting closer to the time when Christ is born. We're getting closer to the time of the Roman Empire. We're already beginning to see them stretching their arms out and putting their powerful play into choosing sides and saying, okay, you can't do this. You got to go back home and we're going to let you rule. Already the Egyptians are becoming nothing more than puppets of the Roman Empire as they get closer to Cleopatra. And during the days of Cleopatra, she pretty much hands over the Egyptian Empire to the Romans there around 30 AD, which is just about 27, 30 years before the time of Christ. So all these things are bringing us closer. These are the types of people that are ruling over the lands that the Jews are having to face with. And if you thought the Ptolemies were bad, wait till we talk about the Seleucids. They make some of the Ptolemies, some of the strange, marry their brother, their mother, their sister, whomever, they make them seem like kind of normal individuals. As we look at some of the ways that the Seleucids treated the Jews and those that they conquered. But as we've brought out in each of these lessons, one of the main things we need to understand, and the reason we keep going back to the prophecies there in the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 2 and in Daniel chapter 8, God planned all these things out. He didn't necessarily plan exactly every player and everything, but He planned these empires. We see there in Daniel chapter 2 that there were going to be four empires that were going to rise up before He set up His kingdom. God set up His kingdom upon this earth. We've already gone through the Babylonian Empire, which Daniel said that you're the first, Nebuchadnezzar. And after you's going to rise another one that's inferior to you, the Medes and the Persians. And after then, a third one, which we saw was the Greeks. And as we saw in Daniel chapter 8, with that Greek Empire, that notable horn burst and four rise in its place, and you have the breakup of the Grecian Empire, and then finally we're going to be looking at the Romans. These things have to take place for God to bring His prophecy and to come to pass. The Roman Empire, that fourth empire, has to be in place when God sets up His kingdom. Now, there's something for you to understand, because there's a lot of people today that are still looking for the kingdom, aren't they? They're still waiting for God to set up His kingdom here upon this earth. And when you look just at the prophecies there in Daniel, we can see that it is in the days of that last empire, the Roman Empire, that God is going to set up His kingdom and that no one can destroy it. And so we're getting rather close to that. And keep that in mind when you're talking to your religious friends and they talk about the kingdom of God has not been set up yet. Well, there you go. It was going to be set up during the days of the Roman Empire. Daniel prophesied of it. We have very clear prophecies in that. But we want to keep in mind that God is in power. He's ruling over the kingdoms of men. He's even ruling over our kingdoms today. He lifts to power those that He wants to be in power. And He uses not such nice individuals to do His will. We saw that with Nebuchadnezzar. We've seen that with some of the Medes and the Persians. We've seen that with the Greeks, and especially with the Ptolemies. His work is being done. His plan is being done. And the thing we need to look at is we must remain faithful. And so if you're not prepared to meet the Lord this evening, then you need to be preparing yourself. Jesus set forth His plan. He gave it rather simply. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who does not believe will be condemned. Peter told him there on the day of Pentecost, he said, "You repent and be baptized, every one of you, for the remission of your sins." Well, that's what you got to do. You've got to hear the Word. You've got to believe it. You've got to repent of your sins. You've got to confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and be buried in baptism. If you've not done those things, then make your life right with God, because we do not know what the morrow would bring. You can just imagine some of these Ptolemies and Cleopatras going to bed at night thinking, "Oh, tomorrow's going to be a great day. I'm ruler." And they were put to death that night. We don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, but we do know that the Lord has promised a day of judgment, and we must be ready for it. If you're not ready for the day of judgment tonight, make yourself ready in whatever way is necessary as we stand and as we sing.